Considering how to do the series of lectures, there are really two basic approaches to intellectual history. One is that one considers the particular writers or authors just in their own context. The view would be that writers of different historical periods have very different problems from those of others, and we can't really find much in common between, say, what the ancient Greeks were saying and what our problems today. So what the intellectual historian has to do is to try to ask what was the background, or what were the underlying assumptions of each writer, and we would be considering things only in their own context. The other approach, which is the one I'll be adopting, is a more pragmatic one, which says there are certain arguments that we're interested in. We want to have certain questions that we want to answer, such as what is the best kind of society or what rights do people have? And we want to look at the past and see possibly the figures in the past had things of value to tell us today about the issues that concern us. And it's hoped that doing so, we won't be distorting anything that the people have said in the past. We won't be, say, asking what did Plato say about left libertarianism, since unfortunately he is unaware that there was such a thing. But we will still be able to find questions of value items of value that the people in the past have to say to us today. Now, in doing so, in adopting this approach, I seem to be committing one of the big sins, according to a very influential essay, a short book that was written by Herbert Butterfield, called The Whig Interpretation of History. And what Butterfield claimed was that it's inaccurate to, or misleading to, have the idea of there's a progression in history leading up to the present, so that we believe we have the correct insights today, so, and then we view figures in the past as leading up to the insights of today. So the question then arises, am I going to, guilty of just this fallacy that Butterfield called attention to? Well, first of all, he doesn't really argue this is a fallacy, just says this is the Whig interpretation, it's no good. But even if it turns out that he's right, that we shouldn't do that, I have a defense that I'm not going to be doing that. I'm not contending that there's any gradual or even sudden progression leading, say, from the ancient Greeks up to modern libertarianism, by which there's a series of insights that are become more and more libertarian as we go on. So it's not, I'm not going to be claiming that there's any kind of progressive trend in the history of political philosophy that leads to modern libertarianism. So although I'm sure I'll be guilty of many sins during these lectures, falling into the Whig interpretation of history is, I hope, not one of them. But this, we now have the question, though, why do we begin with the Greeks? Why am I beginning with lectures on Plato and Aristotle? Well, one reason is that this is obviously in a course you have to begin at the beginning, and these are the beginnings. I don't want to be in the position of Disraeli's wife, who could never remember first which came first, the Greeks or the Romans. So these, but the question, I mean, more seriously, why are the Greek philosophers considered the start of not only history political philosophy, but history of philosophy in general? And this is because the Greeks tried to answer, just by reason, the question, what is the best life, or what is the best political system to adopt? They weren't satisfied with just relying on tradition or following the religious beliefs of their time. They wanted to ask, what, just by using reason, what, if anything, can we discover about the truth about these vital questions? Now, as I, the first, the perhaps the most famous of all the political philosophers that we talk about is Plato, who lived from 427 to 347 BC. The famous remark that everyone always quotes, Alfred Whitehead said that the history of Western philosophy is a series of footnotes to Plato. They're not always agreeing footnotes, I should say. But Plato, we have to consider what was the situation that Plato, when he wrote, was facing. Well, in Greece at the time, as you probably know, Greece was organized in what is called city-states. The city-state is called the polis. The term polis actually comes, it was originally the stronghold in the city, but it was gradually extended to cover the territory of the whole city or the people in the city. And these cities were independent. It wasn't that all the Greeks were unified into one country, like we have the cities in the U.S. today are just part of larger systems. But in Greece, these city-states were independent. I think there were about, in the 5th century B.C., there were about 750 of them. Some were much larger than others. Athens was, for most of the 5th century, the largest of these. Now, at one time, Athens had about 60,000 citizens, and then the total population, which would include non-resident aliens, were called metics, and not to be confused with medics, it's M-E-T-I-C-S, were, and slaves and others would be about 10 times that. So now during the period of Plato's youth, Athens was facing a very tough time, and Athens had been involved in a series of wars that are called the Peloponnesian War. It's really there were three major stages of the Peloponnesian War, but the Athens was in a tremendous fight with another city-state, Sparta. And its allies who were in the Peloponnesian League, and Sparta defeated Athens. Athens lost a big naval battle near the end of the war, and the Athenian government, which was a democracy, was overthrown, I think somewhere around 403 BC. Now, what by democracy, in the Athenian sense, wasn't democracy as we have it today in the U.S., where you vote for your congressman or you vote for a president, and then they run things without really consulting the voters till the next election. On the contrary, in Athens, all the male citizens were part of the participate in the assembly. They would debate all the main laws themselves and pass them. Now, there was a smaller group called the council, which had 500 people. The assembly could have 6,000 at one time. The smaller group could have 500 that would consider the laws and propose them to the assembly. The members of that group were also selected by democratically. They were just chosen by lot. So when Athens was called democracy, they really meant it. It was ruled by the people themselves. But one thing also I should mention, just to get the background of how the city-states work, is that the city-states in general, not just Athens, had very little in the way of a government apparatus. There wasn't much of a state. There wasn't much coercion involved. They could get, things could change when they had military campaigns and you'd have very much organized force. But there wasn't really in the normal course of events in the city-state, there wasn't really much in the way of force. For example, if you read in the Apology, the account of Socrates' last days, it's pretty clear he could have escaped very easily. He didn't have to take the hemlock. He could have gotten out. It would have been very easy for him to arrange an escape. There wouldn't have been border guards and other people. We wouldn't have Secret Service agents trying to stop him, or we wouldn't have to go through the metal detector at the airport to get out. But so the city-state was quite different from the modern coercive state. But because of the loss of the Peloponnesian War, the democratic government was for a while overthrown, and another government called the 30 Tyrants was for a while in power, and this was headed by a man called Critias, who was Plato's uncle. And Plato himself, it's quite clear, had a very negative view of democracy. He didn't like the Athenian system at all. And if you look at one of the dialogues of Gorgias, he has some very nasty comments on Pericles, who was the leading Athenian statesman and proponent of democracy, so he doesn't like him at all. Now, an additional reason besides the fact that Plato's family was involved, it was in the aristocratic party that Plato didn't like democracy, was, remember, the great event of 399 BC, that, as I've already mentioned this in passing, is that Plato's teacher, Socrates, was killed by the Athenian democracy. In Athens, a trial could be conducted just like a regular legislative proceeding, that people could vote a death sentence. The assembly would act as a jury, and they voted a death sentence for Socrates. So this was something that affected Plato very deeply, that his teacher was killed. So now, the background then is that Plato didn't like democracy, but there was, besides Plato's personal distaste for democracy, there was a general skepticism at this time about the nature of morality or traditional practices, traditional ways of doing things. There were people at the time who were very skeptical about morality, and there were some who said that really morality is all a sham. It's just a device that people have to gain power over others. It isn't that there's some kind of moral truth, or that there's some we have some real standards of truth, say based on what the gods have told us or what we get through the traditions of the city. In fact, this is all made up by people for their own purposes. And one of the principal tasks of Plato in his most famous dialogue, which I'll be concentrating on during this lecture, The Republic, is to combat this type of skepticism. He wants to say, no, there is an objective truth about morality. What he's proposing to do is tell us something about that. In the course of doing this, he really founds political philosophy by coming up with his notion of an ideal state. What is the best society? What is the society that's best organized in accordance with true morality? So he's trying to answer, not only say the skeptics are wrong, but he's trying to come say that there is a correct, there is a truth about morality, but he's trying to tell us what is the ideal order, what is the correct way of founding things. Now, as I say, I referred to the Republic as a dialogue, but that isn't really technically correct, because the Republic comes to it's given as a report by Socrates of a conversation. So Socrates, that the whole thing is really related as Socrates' account of a conversation in which he is involved with various other people, such as Glaucon and Adeimantus, who are really in real life Plato's brothers. So it isn't that the dialogue is the Republic is the actual dialogue. It's Socrates' account of this dialogue. Whether that has, I don't know that that has any philosophical significance, but there are people such as Leo Strauss and his followers who contend that every detail of the Platonic dialogue is somehow significant. So if this were lecture given by a Straussian follower of Strauss, he would no doubt point out why that's important. I just mentioned it just as a curiosity. All right, now, so the question then we have that Plato begins with is, as I say, involves the notion of whether there is the nature of truth, nature of justice, I should say. The term that Plato uses, the Greek term dikaiosyne, justice, has a more extended sense. And sometimes today when we talk of justice, we mean something kind of very limited, like John Rawls in Theory of Justice distinguishes justice from other parts of morality. Justice would just involve, say, political rights that people have, but there are other aspects of morality that aren't covered by justice. But Plato's using the term in a more extended term. Dikaiosyne has a more extended sense, so it would have a sense more, he's asking, what is the right? So we should understand it in that way. Now, the question, the dialogue begins where, in which Plato, I mean, Socrates is raising the question of the nature of justice. And I should say, before I should say this, the dialogues, except for the last dialogue, the laws, have Socrates as the figure who's giving the views of the dialogue which is found. There's actually some question. I mean, when you have a dialogue, it's not presented as a general exposition where, say, as you have, say, one of Aristotle's works, you can say, well, this is what Aristotle thought because he's expounding his own views. A dialogue are just given by, we have views that are ascribed to particular characters in the dialogue, but it doesn't follow immediately that those views can be taken as Plato's own. However, most scholars feel that at least in the dialogues of the middle and later period, the Republic is usually dated from, sort of considered a middle dialogue, that when Plato ascribes views to Socrates, he's really giving his own views. There's a dissenting view that was held by two early late 19th, early 20th century philosophical historians, John Burnet and A. Taylor. They said, no, when Plato is talking in the Republic about Socrates, he's really reporting Socrates' own views. This is what Socrates actually believed, but that's a very much a minority view that isn't held today. I should say, by the way, A. Taylor is in one of the greatest of all philosophical book reviewers. As you know, in my own work, I do a great deal of book reviews, so I regard A. Taylor as perhaps the greatest of all book reviewers. He had enormous knowledge of nearly everything, and he would really whenever he reviewed a book, he could point out, usually better than the author of whatever the work was, what were the mistakes of the work. And he once said, well, he spent his holiday reading something like 90 volumes of collected works of Voltaire, and that was just in a few weeks. But as I say, it's but our subject is not a Taylor, but Plato. All right, so the question first comes up that Socrates, what is justice? Now, he turns aside an answer that's proposed by an older man named Cephalus, who was not a citizen of Athens, and his son, Polymarchus. They suggest that justice, at least in part, is giving back what you owe to people. What they very often find in Plato's dialogue, someone will propose a definition, and you'll just give an example of something. So this might be an example of something just, but it can't be justice. You wouldn't say all justice involves giving back what you owe to people. That's just possibly one case. But Socrates raised an objection to this. This is kind of, he brushes this view aside, and he says, well, let's suppose someone had, you had borrowed a knife from somebody, and the person wanted it back, and then you say that the being just is to give him back the knife. But suppose you knew, say, that he wanted to use the knife to stab someone. Would it still be the just thing to do to give him back the knife? And Plato seems to Socrates takes for granted that no, it isn't the just thing to do. Probably Walter Block would disagree with him on that point. So then after Socrates has dismissed that, then the main part of Book One begins. Thrasymachus, who's another character, there was a real life Thrasymachus, Thrasymachus of Chalcedon. He was a teacher of rhetoric. He suggests, he's one of these skeptics about morality that I mentioned earlier. He says, morality is the interest of the stronger. And what does he mean by this? Well, he's not proposing this, I don't think, as a definition of morality, so that we could say, let's say somebody is very strong and acts in his own interest. It wouldn't follow by definition that the person has acted morally. But what he means is rather to take kind of a nihilist view. He's denying there's really any such thing as objective morality. He says, really, we have, we would have in the various city-states, say some would be organized on the basis of different classes. We would have, say, in an oligarchy, the rich would be in power. In a democracy, we have the people in power. So the morals are really conventional. They're just set up, so they're designed to protect the interests of a particular class or group. That you really, morality is, he says, the interest, justice is the interest of another. It's not, you could sometimes do, if you acted justly, it might turn out that it was also in your own interest, but that wouldn't be why you would be acting justly. It would just turn out that by you'd be helping yourself because you'd be conforming to the interests of the dominant group. Now, Socrates doesn't accept this view. What he says is, well, what he tries to do, and this is characteristic of Plato's dialogue, is he tries to show that the views he opposes are the views that are that he at least wishes to question. He tries to show by questioning that these views lead to problems or outright contradiction. This is called the Alenkos. It's you're not presenting your own views right away. Socrates isn't saying, look, you're all wrong. Here's what justice is. That comes only later. What he's first trying to do is say, look, you say justice is the interest of the strong, but I can show you that this, if you hold that, this leads to trouble. So what is the trouble that this leads to? Well, if you say justice is the interest of the strong, how does a group get to be strong? Well, the people in the group would have to cooperate with each other and act justly toward each other. And kind of, in a sense, it wouldn't, if say each person in the dominant group just acted in it out of pure self-interest and did everything his way and didn't care about the other people in the group, then the group couldn't be dominant at all. So it can't be that, as Thrasymachus said, justice is in the interest of the stronger, because that wouldn't explain the justice within the dominant group itself. That wouldn't be, so it can't be that that's the correct account of justice. Glaucon now proposes a different view, which is, it sounds like the reverse of the Thrasymachus' view. And he says, no, justice is really interest of the weaker. It's that the weak people get to think that it would be very bad if the strong started bossing them and tyrannizing over them. So they get everyone somehow to accept a view that we shouldn't do various things. We shouldn't steal from each other. We shouldn't murder each other. They get these views accepted because they would it makes them better off. Then the weaker don't have to worry about, or at least not worry as much about, being attacked by the strong. They could just say, "We have these rules of morality, so you don't have to." The strong won't oppress them because they'll be following these rules. Now, the view that Glaucon proposes really is extremely influential in later philosophy. In the form he gives it, it sounds rather like something Nietzsche suggested. And there's another character in one of the other dialogues, Callicles in the Gorgias, who gives a similar view of morality. But the Glaucon's view is really, as I say, much more influential in that it's part of a view that says that morality really rests on conventions that are accepted in our self-interest. Say, it wouldn't be in our interest, say, if we lived in a society where we thought people might regularly attack us without warning. Say, if you thought, say, while you're listening to this lecture, if you thought someone might come in the room and machine gun everybody, this would probably make you somewhat nervous. I certainly wouldn't be very happy about it. So, although it would have its advantages, I suppose. So it's because it's in our interest not to have, say, disruptions like that. We all want to live in a society where people don't aggress against each other or don't steal the property we've acquired according to the rules of society. Things will go much better for all of us in the sense of better in terms of enabling us to realize whatever it is we want. So so that's why we have such rules. So this is the, this is extremely influential view, but Glaucon doesn't propose this as his own view. He just says, he asks Socrates, he says, well, can you refute this view? Can you show us that justice is more desirable in itself? We have to ask, what does Glaucon mean by that? What is he asking? What is he asking Socrates to do? And here, I think we should note rather, perhaps first a rather odd fact, that the view that I mentioned, Thrasymachus' whole morality is in the interest of the stronger, seems like it's the opposite of the one Glaucon says, morality, justice is in the interest of the weaker. But everyone in the conversation takes them to be really variants of the same view. It isn't that Glaucon has said, oh no, Thrasymachus is all wrong, he's got the reverse of the truth. He just takes the view he suggested as really the quite similar to Thrasymachus, and he's asking Socrates to somehow come up with something different. So a key question then is, what is it that he's asking? Glaucon is suggesting is that if you view morality in this conventional way, then you're saying morality or justice is good because of certain consequences that it has. Say, I'm not going to kill anybody because if I know that if I did that, bad things will happen to me because, say, the legal system will take care of me in a way I don't like, so I'm not going to do anything. But I wouldn't be thinking, if I did that, I wouldn't be thinking there's anything intrinsically good about justice. And Glaucon makes this, the difference very vivid to us by some examples. He suggests, the first one's famous, Ring of Gyges example. It's actually called the Ring of Gyges, although in the story it isn't Gyges who has the ring, but it's an ancestor of his who's supposed to have the ring. And this is a ring that if you put it on, you would become invisible, so no one would not be able to detect your presence. So Glaucon said, well, supposing we could somehow do whatever we wanted, or we were invisible, no one would know what we're doing, then on the self-interest account, wouldn't we then we wouldn't follow the rules of morality? Say, if I saw something I wanted, I would just take it. I wouldn't say it's unjust to steal property from others. I would just take it because it would have no bad consequences for me. And we could raise a question here, perhaps, is this really a fair question? I mean, if we ask, say someone liked a conventionalist account of morality, you could just say, well, morality is designed for the way people the conditions under which people actually exist or something, conditions pretty close to that. So maybe it isn't fair to say, well, how would people behave or if things are radically different, say, why is that question? What would people do if they could become invisible? Is that really a relevant question? But regardless of how you answer that, the second challenge that Glaucon proposes is, I think, more telling to this conventionalist view. He imagines a case in which someone who is conventionally is a good person by these conventional standards. However, everybody thinks he's a bad person. Everybody thinks he's someone who's violating the laws of justice and treats him accordingly. On the other hand, supposing somebody was actually very bad, he was always acting unjustly, but no one knows this about him. They think he's a just person and they treat him very well. So Glaucon said, well, which would we rather be? Would we rather be the just person who was treated as if very badly, as if he were an unjust, or would it be rather, would we rather be an unjust person with the reputation of being just? And Glaucon says, on the self-interest view, on the view that morality is really in the interest, in our own interest, or in the interest of the majority or the people, interest of the weak people, we would have to say the reputation is the more important thing. But if we said that, then we wouldn't be really saying that morality or justice is intrinsically valuable. We would just be saying it's something that it we would do just because of certain consequences that don't intrinsically attach to it. It's just worked out because of the social system we have that it's on the whole better for us not to be to act justly. But it's we can see it's like the slogan or the saying we have, honesty is the best policy. Well, this is very often true. Say if you go into a store and the storekeeper cheats you, you're not going to find out about this. You're not going to go back to that store anymore. But that doesn't show, say, that the storekeeper really values honesty, just thinks that because of the way we have our economic and political system, it won't pay to be dishonest. So what Glaucon is asking Socrates is, can you come up with something that shows that justice is really valuable in a way that goes beyond convention? Now, I think in understanding this question, it's important to see that what Glaucon is asking is in a sense is not as far away from the view that says how is morality in our interest as one could imagine. There was a famous article that came out published in the magazine called Mind in 1912 by the Oxford philosopher H.A. Pritchard, called "Does Moral Philosophy Rest on a Mistake?" Certainly a good title for an article. So what Pritchard said is there are various theories of morality. Say morality is, say the utilitarians say morality, what's the moral thing to promote is what promotes the greatest happiness. Or we have all sorts of other theories. But he said all these theories have a common failing. They ask the question, how is morality in our interest in some sense? But this is the wrong thing. If something is our moral duty, we have to do it just because it's our duty. We can't to ask the question, why is it in your interest to be moral, is to ask a question that puts us completely outside the moral standpoint. So if I said, if I see a book here that I want, why shouldn't I take it? Of course, I wouldn't in this case take the book since they're my books. I certainly don't want those. But so suppose I said, why shouldn't I take it? So even if I ask, say, if I steal, even if I could show this would lead to a bad life for me in a way that doesn't depend on what other people do to me. Say it's just I'll find I'm ultimately unhappy if I engage in theft or if I violate people's rights. According to Pritchard, this isn't really an answer that reflects a moral standpoint. I have to say stealing is wrong. I shouldn't steal just because stealing is wrong. That's all there is to it. It's just there it is. There's the moral rule. That's the whole thing. There's nothing further to, there's no question on why be moral other than saying we ought to do our duty. That's it. Now that certainly was not what Socrates or Plato had in mind. That would be a very un-Greek way of looking at things. No, I don't think no Greek thinker would have thought that. What Glaucon is asking and what Socrates tries to supply is to show that justice and morality really will lead to a better life for us in some sense in which that's not dependent on what, legal or political consequences. Something like when he's saying what is intrinsically good about justice, it has to be what he's asking for. He says, what is it about behaving justly that will enable us to lead a better life? Why is this part of a better life to act justly? Now, how does Socrates propose to answer this question? Well, what he does first is essentially to answer the question is he points out that the soul or the mind, the human mind, really is not unified. They're really three parts, or three constituents of the soul. And we have first reason, which is which he thinks is the most valuable, the most important one. And we have desire. People have all sorts of passions. We want, say, we have a like or want various things. Say, we could have all sorts of things, whatever it is we want, food, also anything that attracts us, is some things we don't want, our desires. And then there's an intermediate class that she called the spirited side. We get the word thumos, the Greek word, is for spirit. That's where, you remember, Mises, von Mises in Theory and History talks about phimology, which is a study of introspective psychology, really not something that's deductive like praxeology, but just based on people's experience. So he takes the word thumos, from this Greek term, although it doesn't mean the same thing in Mises as it does there. But the spirited side would be really if we have reason and desire, we would have a question. If, say, we decide to act on our desire, Plato thinks there's a third part of the mind that really is a spirit that really puts this into practice. I could have all sorts of different desires, but I pick one, but how does that get me actually to do it? Plato thinks it's the spirit, sort of the executive part of the soul, and this is especially the feelings of anger and feel honor and shame would be examples of the spirited part of the soul. So this, as you'll see, is the key to Plato and Socrates' account of justice. In trying to show that the soul is divided into parts, Socrates gives the example, and he says, well, suppose I can have a case where I want something, say I have a strong desire, say, to drink, I really like to drink some water. I feel tremendously thirsty. I want to really drink a lot of water. But say, I could also at the same time feel that I shouldn't drink the water. Let me just, is my example not the one given the Republic? I'm supposing, say, I was undergoing some medical test and they told me, don't drink anything for the next few hours, but I feel tremendously thirsty. I really like to drink something, but at the same time, I feel very nervous about, I don't want to upset this medical test, so I don't drink. So Socrates said, well, how could you have if the mind were entirely unified, you would be say you have only, how could you have a desire at the same time both for something. I want to drink at the same time, have a desire not to drink. It can't be that if the mind is entirely unified, it would have contradictory or seemingly contradictory properties. So that's a reason to think the mind isn't unified. And Fred Miller, I think, calls this the principle of non-opposition, that you can't ascribe contradictory properties to something at the same time. This is, I think, one of the first uses of this basic logical principle in the history of philosophy. So, although, as you'll be seeing later, there are strong reasons to disagree with Plato on many things in his philosophy, he was quite a smart person. I mean, after all, using the principle of non-contradiction for the first time is really something that's worth noting. It's one of the first uses of this principle. So, all right, so we now have the mind have these three parts: reason, the spirited part, and desire. So, Socrates asked, if we want to know what is the nature of justice, so we can answer Glaucon's question of why should we be just, Socrates said, we should look at really the soul written in a larger, and what he says is, by that he means, he said we should examine the nature of a city, because the city in some way corresponds to the soul. So he says, just like supposing you had a text written in small letters, and you had trouble reading the text, one thing you could do is take a magnifying, look at it in a larger example, get a bigger example of this. So he says, this is something we can do for the nature of justice. We could say, what is justice in the city? And this will help us see what is justice in the soul, and we can see possibly why it's valuable. Now then, what happens though if it turns out that we don't think they're the same? Well then, Socrates suggests we can just keep going back and forth and trying to adjust our views till we get a balance between, better fit between what's true for the soul and what's true for the city. So here then, in pursuing this analogy, is really where the Socrates really gives the basic political doctrine that's propounded in the Republic. And what he says is, in an ideal city, we would have reason would be in control. So what he has is that there's in the city there are separate classes corresponding to each part of the soul. There's the workers, the people who do all the menial work, keep things going, are in his, Socrates suggests, are governed by desire. These are people who are dominated by passion. Then we have, there's the warriors, the people who are the military part of the city, who both defend the city from other cities and also sometimes will attack other cities, because the ideal city sometimes needs to get more territory from other cities. So these warriors will be the ones who handle that. They're the ones who are dominated by spirit. And then the highest group is the guardians. These are the people who are governed by reason, so they'll be in control. And in the city, we have that it's desirable, according to Socrates, Socrates representing Plato, to have the city would be as unified as possible. So it's particularly important for the guardian class and also the warriors. They want to have everyone having similar ideas as possible. And Plato proposes a communism of property and marriage that you get married to a single person, there's nothing like that. People don't form permanent attachments, but there's just it's decided by the periodic days that are set aside, calculated according to a certain numerological basis, where people are supposed to mate according to what's considered to be likely to produce the best offspring, and that's how you get the new generation. It's not, people can't decide this sort of thing for themselves. Now, I must say, at first sight, this doesn't sound like it's the system that reason dictates. So why is it that Socrates thinks that? What is supposed to be so reasonable about this? Why is it that Plato thought that the guardians would be in total control? What is it that the guardians are supposed to know that gives them this power over everyone else, that they're in charge, other people have to do what they say? What is it that they're supposed to know? Well, here we have to make some reference to one of the most difficult and controversial parts of Plato's philosophy, the doctrine of forms or ideas. And what suggested is in the middle books of the Republic, we ask what is the essence of anything? Like, say, suppose I have a square. We say, what is the essence of a square? I just had imagined a square object. The essence isn't the physical thing, say, that I'm looking for. So I say, this lectern is a rectangle. So the real rectangle, quality of being rectangle, isn't this physical embodiment of the rectangle, because after all, it wouldn't be perfectly, say this, it isn't perfectly rectangular. Probably if you measure it, it would be slightly off, and even if we kept measuring it more and more closely, we'd find imperfections in it. The real rectangle is something that exists not in anything physical, but separate from this. It's somewhat of an abstraction. It's an abstract realm that's apart from the physical objects. And there were, in the different dialogues, there are different views on whether every object has such a form corresponding to it. But for the ones that do have forms corresponding to it, and it's the abstract object, this abstract form is the real quality of the real object. It isn't, say, we could imagine, say, various beautiful people or beautiful houses or various other things beautiful, but that wouldn't be beauty itself. So what's really beautiful is not any of these things. These are just beauty imperfectly, but the beautiful itself, which would be somehow apart from the things that are constantly changing in the world. One reason Plato was attracted to this view, he thought that if we have knowledge, in order to have knowledge, by knowledge he meant this in a very strong sense, something that we're it's absolutely certain, can't possibly be otherwise. He thought we could have knowledge only of what was unchanging, only what couldn't be different. Say if we have look at various objects around us, they could be different, they change from time to time, or people, say, view them from different perspectives. Say if I'm looking at this lecture, I'm looking down at it from a certain way, it looks one way, but somebody in a different part of the room was looking at it, would see it at a different angle, so it would be somehow slightly different. So this wouldn't be real knowledge. Real knowledge has to be something that's absolutely unchanging, doesn't change at all. Now, to some extent, mathematics gives us knowledge, but even this isn't good enough, according to Plato. And this, there's a famous passage in the Republic called the divided line, where the mathematicals aren't at the absolute top. And what was wrong with mathematics? I mean, it seems like there, don't you have this kind of necessary knowledge that Plato wants? Well, there are two problems with it. First of all, that mathematicians, at least this was true in Plato's time, use diagrams in their arguments, but a diagram is something too concrete. I mean, say if you use in a geometric proof, you draw, say, a square or a triangle, it won't be perfect square or triangle. It'll, just since it's physical, be slightly imperfect. So by using the diagram, you haven't really gotten to the highest truth. Plus, and perhaps even more important, mathematics uses certain premises that are insufficiently justified. And Plato thinks that by further investigation of the forms, we could come up with absolutely true, absolute truth that in some doesn't rest on any unjustified premises. Now, then when we have the forms, there's a highest form, which is called the form of the good, and it's the philosophers, the guardians, after, because they've been very carefully trained, they've seen the form of the good, and this is what enables them to, this is why they're in control, because they've gotten the highest, they've been in contact, they know the highest form, so this enables them to rule everyone else. They've known the highest, the form of the good, nobody else does, because it requires all these years of training to be able to advance that far. And to get to that part, you have to study mathematics first, because this is sort of you can't just say, well, let's forget about the math and all the other things. I want to go right to the highest. I want to get right to the form of the good so I can get in, become one of the rulers all right away. No, you can't do that. You have to go through this very careful program of mathematical training, then you get to know the form of the good. Now, there's a big problem with all of this, is that Plato, nowhere, either in the Republic or in any other dialogue, tells us very much about what the form of the good is. It's just we know this is the highest form, but he doesn't say very much about what it is or why it is that knowing this is supposed to give you wisdom. But he doesn't really suggest that he himself at any point really had grasped fully the form of the good. There are various speculations on what he might have meant by the form of the good. One, which was given by the Oxford philosopher H.W.B. Joseph, I think, gave a series of lectures on it called Knowledge and the Good in Plato's Republic. He thought the form of the good was really not a particular separate form, but just grasping how you would grasp how all the various forms are fully unified systematically. That's an interesting suggestion, but there's been a great deal of debate on what the form of the good is. But somehow, if you know that, you would, this makes you somehow more equipped to rule, or equipped to, that you would be in charge, because you would be part of the reasonable, the only group that's grasped reason fully. No one else would have done that, so they then have to do what the philosophers, what the guardians say, because it's the guardians who know the truth. And in holding this view, going to be a fundamental theme in the subsequent lectures, assuming there are any subsequent lectures after this one. Does the notion of an objective morality, objective truth, lead to an authoritarian political system of the kind Plato favored? Is it that if there's an objective truth, then people who know that truth are going to have the right to rule other people who don't? It was an interesting book that published a couple of years ago, short book by the economist James Buchanan called Why I Too Am Not a Conservative. And he suggests that basic to classical liberalism, libertarian view, is to hold that there isn't an objective moral truth in that sense, because he said he thinks if you held there was such a thing, then you would be committed to some form of authoritarianism. So we would have to ask, we'll be asking in the lectures, is this a correct account of things? But regardless of how we answer that, there's a basic problem in the position that has been set out so far. Remember, what the position was is that we want to find out, is there, what is the nature of justice? Will being just, is that being part of the good life, part of the best life? And to answer that question, Socrates posed a parallel, or an analogy between the city and the soul. The city is the soul written large. But the problem, if we do with this analogy, is that in order to be just, according to the view that being propounded here, reason has to be in control of the passions and the spirited part of the soul. But in the city, in the ideal city, although the guardians represent reason, are in control of the warriors and the workers, the warriors and the workers, by the hypothesis we're giving, are not controlled by reason. They don't have wisdom. That's just why they're not guardians. They're not controlled by wisdom. But then we have, if that's true, then in the ideal city, in the just city, most people are not just. So we have the ideal city would be composed of people who aren't themselves rational, or would not be, not be just. And so the whole analogy really breaks down there. There's a famous article by Bernard Williams pointing this out, so that there's really the whole analogy really seems it doesn't work, because you make the just city be composed largely of people who aren't just. Now, one reason Plato might have done this, is that at least at that point in his career, he really didn't care much about non-philosophers. He thought that people who weren't philosophers, who hadn't grasped wisdom, really weren't fully human in the full sense. So he's really just concerned with the guardians. But even if that's the case, that it's still the whole basic analogy of the Republic really breaks down in this way. Now there's a further problem with the basic argument of the Republic. It was pointed out in another famous article which came out in 1963 in the Philosophical Review by David Sachs, it's S-A-C-H-S, called A Fallacy in Plato's Republic. I should say David Sachs was a friend of mine. I rate him one of the three most sarcastic people I've ever met. It would be easy to tell all sorts of David Sachs stories, but I'll refrain from doing that right now. But what the fallacy, what David Sachs pointed out, and this has been his question has been much discussed by writers after that, like Gregory Vlastos, Terence Irwin, and others, is what the question Thrasymachus and Glaucon were raising is, when they say, why should we be just? What is justice? They mean by justice something like conventional morality in the ordinary sense, like why shouldn't I kill or assault people whenever I feel like it? Why shouldn't I steal? So the answer that's been given is that in the soul and in the ideal city, reason should be in control of the passions. But what Sachs pointed out is this really doesn't answer the question, because supposing reason is in control of the passions, then does it follow that a rational person wouldn't do any of these bad things in the ordinary sense? According to Sachs, Plato is guilty of what he called the fallacy of irrelevance. He's just shifted. He hasn't answered the question, but he shifted it to some other question, namely, how is it that reason should control the passions and the spirited part of the soul? But he hasn't told us really why we should be just in the ordinary language sense. Now, I think probably the best answer to this, Richard Kraut, who's another influential student of ancient philosophy, suggests that Plato thought that the main reason people would violate conventional morality is that they were overcome by passion. Say somebody was very greedy and wanted to he would steal something because felt very greedy, so he would just take what didn't belong to him. But a rational person wouldn't do this. Now, so that would be really how I think probably the best reply to Sachs's point on the fallacy of irrelevance. Now, I should say I concentrated mostly on the Republic, but there's another dialogue, which was Plato's last dialogue, The Laws, in which he gives a different account of a different scheme for how a city should be organized. And this one is again not very libertarian, but it's different from the one given in the Republic. And this is described, the Laws is the dialogue in which Socrates doesn't figure. The one who represents Plato's views is called the Athenian stranger. And what what's suggested there is it's a dialogue that where it's proposed to have a colony in part of Crete, a city, they're going to establish a city in part of Crete. It's called Magnesia. The ideal city in the Republic is called Callipolis, the beautiful city. But this one is called Magnesia. And in this one, it's called the second best city. Plato, it's in the Republic, it said that this is described as a politics in the heavens, where it suggested this couldn't really be put into practice. It's too good for actually put into practice, but perhaps this one actually can be practiced. Now, there's a question that's been, interesting question, raised by Christopher Babonich, a very good book called on the laws called Plato's Utopia Recast. And he said, well, everybody is assuming in the laws that when Plato talks about the second best city, he means that the best city is the one described in the Republic. But this doesn't follow. He does say that the best city is one which you have communism of property and wives and women, but this that doesn't follow that that means that the ideal city is the one in the Republic. He just said, well, this we couldn't in practice realize communism of women and property, but he doesn't say that. He doesn't refer to the Republic. In fact, what he's talking about there would be what he says can't be realized as universal communism of women and property. But in the city described in the Republic, it's not, that isn't the case. The workers do not have to have, can have private property and ordinary marriages. So it's not clear. The first best city in the laws really is the Republic. Is the city described in the Republic. But in the laws, we have, instead of a guardian class of philosophers, there's really a group, there's a legislative body. The city is divided into four classes based on property. But these classes, the property differences really aren't all that much. But there's a legislative body and also a group of guardians who are really in charge. But these are not particularly philosophers, although they're supposed to be the older and wiser parts of the city, but they're not philosophers. And in fact, the laws are supposed to have, that are set out, are supposed to have preambles giving the purposes of a law so people can grasp what the laws are for. So it's different from the Republic, in which wisdom is confined to the guardian class, and the non-philosophers don't really matter. Remember one detail I'm sure you're familiar with, I didn't mention this, in the Republic, in the system describing the Republic, there's what is called the noble lie. The people are told that when they're born, their souls have different metals in them. They're gold, silver, and bronze, and iron. And the reason they say the workers, if say the worker were to ask, why do I have to be in the lowest group? They would say, because your soul has the bronze or iron in it. So this deception isn't practiced in the laws. In the laws, you have preambles telling the people what the laws are for. However, as I say, this by no means is the law a system of a libertarian system. On the contrary, there's a institution called the Nocturnal Council, and this group can investigate people who don't subscribe to the official religion. Now, the official religion of the society is a sort of what is one of the it's called the civil theology. It's used the term of a I think it was used by the writer, Varro, one of the later classical authors, called Civil Theology, in which that everyone in the city has to believe. And Plato gives a version of the cosmological argument that we know we can establish that there's a first cause of the world, and that people will be punished or rewarded by what they do in their life. And people are required, they're educated to accept this civil theology, and they're required to believe it. If they don't, the Nocturnal Council can imprison them and sort of subject them to what we could call a period of brainwashing for, I think it was 5 years. And if they still didn't accept the civil theology, then they would be executed. The system is not exactly the one described in Ethics of Liberty. But at any rate, it does show that perhaps in this later dialogue, Plato was had a somewhat higher opinion of the capabilities of people than he did in the Republic. Now, the last thing I will mention before I open it up for some questions is there's a particular strand in history political philosophy that I'll be describing from time to time, which is called the Straussian school. This is followers of the political theorist and historian philosophy, Leo Strauss, who was lived, I think, 1899-1973, who taught at New School for Social Research and then University of Chicago. And he wrote a number of I tend not to accept the theories of his theories and views in his school, but he was extremely learned person who had very influential interpretations of all sorts of different political philosophers. Extremely hard to do this, but he did this. He's managed to revolutionize views in a number of different areas. He had new interpretations of Plato, new interpretations of Maimonides and Al-Farabi in medieval philosophy, has new views of Rousseau, Hobbes, and Locke, and all sorts of different fields. He was able to come up with new interpretations. And what the Straussians say about Plato, you can find this, for example, in Strauss's book, The City and Man, is that when Plato described the system in the Republic, what he was doing was, he wasn't advocating that system. He didn't really say that he didn't really hold that this was the best possible system. On the contrary, he says by describing the conditions that would have to be put into effect before we could have this city. For example, that everyone over the age of 10 would have to be expelled from the city before this city could be founded. He was trying to show that this city could never be realized. He was saying, if you really want to try to think of what would be involved in a system where the philosophers would rule, you could see this is not a desirable or possible thing at all. According to Strauss, Plato was really being satirical in the Republic. He's saying, this is what you get if you try to come up with all these schemes of philosophers ruling. The philosophers should really stay to their proper business, which is really just think about the nature of truth and philosophical problem, not try to rule themselves. Because what you'll get if they do is just this ridiculous system that's described in the Republic. and that some of the Straussian, some of Strauss's followers say what Plato really favored, contrary to what people think. Plato was really pretty sympathetic to democracy, which doesn't account for all the awful things he says about it in the Republic. He says democracy is really a system where people are dominated by different passions and reason really isn't in control. So they say, for example, one who takes his view, there's a book by one Straussian called David Ruchnik, I think it's called the Beautiful City, the Dialectic in Plato's Republic. So what he says is, well, really the conversation that Republic depicts could only have taken place in a democracy. So what the message Plato is giving is really philosophy needs democracy. So Plato is really a good Democrat, which I don't think that there's this view can be accepted, because one item against it is, well, if Plato wanted to say the philosophers shouldn't rule, why did he go to this very elaborate description of the best city? Why do you have to go through all that to get to this conclusion that philosophy shouldn't rule? We have additionally Aristotle, who was after all Plato's student, takes the in when he criticizes Plato in Book Two of the Politics, he takes very seriously the proposal that Plato gives. He certainly doesn't treat them as if they were satirical. So I think that that view ought to be rejected. So as I say, in conclusion, I think the most important thing to take away from this lecture is, if we think there is an objective truth about justice, about morality, will this lead to an authoritarian system, the kind depicted in the Republic? So I think in the little time remaining, we'll have questions. Dan.
Okay. I have kind of a double question that I think will speak to the Straussian elements and also perhaps the historicist criticism of Plato. And I'd like to get your opinion first on the argument that can be made that what Plato is presenting is actually more of a political program in disguise than it is a strictly good faith philosophical program. That in fact, for example, the Republic resembles in many of its sort of broad tendencies the Spartan state, and that perhaps Plato has more of a concrete set of ideas that he wants to kind of subtly introduce and propagate, as opposed to simply coming up with a philosophical program. That, for example, the reason why we get this apparent break between the chain of reasoning from the individual soul to the city is that, well, actually, Plato isn't interested in the individual soul at this point. He's actually interested in certain kinds of reforms of the city, a kind of crypto-Cretian program. And then I guess so that's the historicist, perhaps, attack on Plato. And from the Straussian side, there's also this other element of Strauss, or some of the Straussians, and I forget exactly which of them made this claim, but they say that Thrasymachus is really where Plato is coming from. Plato actually believes in the idea that morality genuinely is the rule of the stronger. There's the element within Straussianism which uses democracy as a cover for what is actually pure power politics. So I thought I would throw out some of those concepts and see what you answer.
Oh, yes, well, I'm supposed to repeat the question. And so you had a two-part question. The first was a historicist point about Plato, that some people think that what Plato's aim wasn't principally philosophical, but that he had particular political goals in mind that he wants to insinuate subtly in the Republic. For example, he admired the Spartan state and he wanted to perhaps suggest that should be sort of Spartan measures should be put into practice. And then there was another part, which the Straussian view, some Straussians hold that Thrasymachus is really reflects Plato's actual views, and that he holds that he really does hold that morality is in the interest of the stronger, and that he's really concerned to defend power politics in the book. Well, on the first part of the question, I don't think that it could be said that Plato's entirely in favor of Sparta. He makes some criticisms of Sparta also. I mean, they would be ones who would be really Spartan state, in his view, would really be dominated by the spirited elements. They wouldn't really be controlled by reason. Now, of course, followers of this interpretation could just say, oh, that's just window dressing. He doesn't really hold that. But then I would want to say, what is the real evidence that people who favor this have for dismissing the philosophical parts of the book? Now here, when we ask the question, this gets into the Straussian side of the question. Now, probably a Straussian state would say, well, the real reason we should dismiss these philosophical aspects of the book, of the dialogue, and favor either the historicist or the Straussian view, is that we see that there are contradictions in the philosophical doctrine. But then the view apparently is that if there are problems or contradictions in the book, that really the author has put them there deliberately. It can't be that Plato has actually made mistakes or there are questionable points in the argument, that he's put them in. It must be to insinuate there's something wrong with the view. And I don't really see much reason to adopt that view. On the Straussian view, I would say if Thrasymachus the whole dialogue is to show us that Thrasymachus was really right, he's certainly taken a long way around to do it. I mean, if you want to show a position is right, you don't write a long book defending the opposite position. I'm sure the Straussians would have a response to that, but I'm not convinced that it's the case. It may be, though, that I would say this position power problem, that may have been Strauss's own position. I mean, I think you could make a better case that Strauss himself said this. I mean, I think people who say that mainly relying on Strauss's lectures called The City and Man, where he seems to suggest that, but I think it's more a better case you could make for Strauss, that Strauss's own view, than for describing that view to Plato. Anybody else? Rodney.
If you have your canon book, you can have a book from Milton Friedman that said, the good thing we don't know what sin is, if we knew, we would have to legally prohibit it.
Yes, I mean, that's exactly the point that you say, if there is a moral truth, then don't you have to put it into practice in an authoritarian way? And to give away what I think is the correct answer to this line is, well, what if the objective truth turns out to be that people should have a right to freedom, that you shouldn't do that? Why can't that be the objective truth, especially since it is? So it's not the case that if you hold there's an objective truth about morality that will lead to authoritarian politics. It just depends on what you hold is the truth, whether you get enough authoritarian view or not. Yeah.
I have a question. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about Plato's ideas, particularly in the Republic and the Laws, the relationship between aesthetics and politics. When I say aesthetics, not so much like art criticism, but, you know, concepts of value and beauty. You made a good point about tying in the concept of the city as this kind of ideal framework where there's these very unperfect people, particularly in divided into classes, like the warriors and the workers don't seem to have reason, right? So in Plato's Republic, Plato makes a big fuss about the virtues of a proper guardian, a legislator,
and then he kind of makes fun of people who try to see virtue in the peasants, for example. He says, oh, the peasants, they're beautiful and have culture and philosophy and festivals, but they really can't govern, you know? So to what extent, if you talk a little bit more, to what extent is in classical Greek ideas as represented by Plato, aesthetics really close to how political philosophy is laid out?
Oh, well, the question is, to what extent in Greek philosophy, in Plato, is aesthetics related to politics? Well, I think in the Plato, when he talks about the good, I mean, he certainly, remember, the name of the ideal city is Kallipolis, you know, the beautiful city, and the Greek word kalon, beautiful, is very much connected to justice. I mean, so there is a very definite connection that's sort of really the form of the beautiful is, I think, very closely connected with the form of the good. So in the, generally the Greeks would not view them as separately as we do today. We don't have, as I mentioned earlier in the lecture, we don't have a sense of a moral obligation as something just standing completely by itself so that people have to do certain things for just for no reason. These are the moral and the good and the beautiful are all intrinsically related. But I think now, fortunately, the time saved me from having to go into how they're related. Okay, thanks very much. That ends the first lecture.